This is Cameron McCune and Bob Dobbs once again for episode number 49. And it's actually May 19th, 2022. So we're looking at my book slash pamphlet. We're at the bottom, page 97. If you want to check it out, listen to us, or follow along. So we have a quote right above where I want to start. McLuhan says, "All these convulsive changes, as I've already noted, carry with them attendant pain, violence, and war, the normal stigmata of the identity quest. But the new society is springing so quickly from the ashes of the old that I believe it will be possible to avoid the transitional anarchy many predict. Automation and cybernation can play an essential role in smoothing the transition to the new society." That's from Playboy. So then I say, this is 1969, meaning that it's the Playboy issue, March 1969. Then I say, actually, probably late 68, because I talked to Mark Stewart and, I don't know, Barry, Nevitt, maybe Eric, is that, so what I say is the story. The interviewer, Eric Norden, who was a regular interviewer for Playboy, couldn't understand anything McLuhan was saying. McLuhan had to write out the answers for him. That's why a lot of the answers by McLuhan seem like they were written. They don't seem the way someone would talk, not colloquially in a Playboy interview. And so that's the reason if they seem, I don't know, overwhelming, too articulate, too precise. But it was probably better that McLuhan wrote out the answers since he wanted to be as clear as possible. You write out the stuff. If they're going to give you an opportunity to do it, write it out. So that's an interesting thing, but it might put off people about McLuhan himself because it doesn't seem natural enough. Now, I met Eric Norden's friend, Paris Flamand, an American writer. And so I have here, Norden and I met his friend. That's said wrong. I met Norden's friend, Paris Flamand, with whom you can hear an interview I did at, you have to contact me. You have to be shown where it is. This was Paris Flamand. So Paris Flamand, Eric Norden's best friend, told me that he heard a lot of complaints from Eric Norden. So I have here, Paris Flamand was listening to Eric complain about his interview with McLuhan. I have here it is, a nice happy time in 64 or 65 when they, the nebulous people, I guess, the masses, believed experts could do something. But by 1969, so I should say here it was a nice happy time, 64 or 65, but now it's 69, all kinds of disturbing phenomena had happened. First of all, their kids went nuts in quotes, ran off to San Francisco in 67. That's American kids, some Canadians. The music changed. Then North Vietnam did the Tet Offensive in January 68, and that messed up the Vietnam War optimism. Then Martin Luther King was killed, followed by Robert Kennedy. Martin Luther King was April, Robert Kennedy was June. The same day, within a few hours, Andy Warhol was shot. And with that, he was pissed that Kennedy stole all the coverage from him. Then the Democratic riots in Chicago in August 68. These seem tame now, but back then you had sort of a general serenity in America on the surface, at least in the news. These mass disruptions was new for America. New since for several decades, I guess, going back to World War II or the 30s. Then I say you have the Democratic conventions, Republican conventions, then in the fall, the disaster of Nixon winning the election. It's a disaster for large numbers of the baby boomers who were out running around protesting and probably were a very small minority, but the media exaggerated them. It's a good new phenomenon. It was like the boomer generation was going through all these phases, and the media was ready to make a big deal out of them. And I guess that created self-consciousness in the baby boomers. But the Nixon represented sort of something counter to the 60s. So I have here, the disaster of Nixon winning the election. The mafia puppet wins the presidency. Now, if you study people like Mae Brussel, you find out Nixon was very involved with the mafia, and a lot of stuff has come out since then. But I don't think people would believe that back in 68, that Nixon was a mafia person. At best, McLuhan was right to say Nixon's face was not charismatic. He hung his face, too much of his private face, out. McLuhan recommended he should grow sideburns and put mustaches on and stuff to put on a bit of a corporate image of the tribal fads of the day. But he didn't. He hung his, what was the phrase? His bare face out. It's in Culture's Our Business, some phrase. Hung out his bare face. Do you remember that?
Well, I remember the general idea. You talked about it a lot, but I don't remember the particular phrase that you're referring to.
Yeah. Said, oh, well. And now it's 1969. This is after Nixon wins in November 69. I say you've had a lot of convulsive changes. That's McLuhan's quote from McLuhan. Convulsive changes that McLuhan's referring to. So if McLuhan was doing the interview in the late 68, everything that I've said had happened. In November 68, around the time McLuhan may be still writing this for Eric Norden, Nixon comes in and there's a kind of chill in the world. Norman Mailer writes some interesting novels about this period, if you want to check that out. So you've had a lot of convulsive changes that McLuhan's referring to. In a way, McLuhan was on top of the convulsive changes. He was noting them more than your average head-in-the-sand kind of academic. So he was the perfect guy to sum up 68, you know.
Notice that McLuhan is noting the changes, but also expressing a confidence that they're going to be solved.
Through automation. What the heck would that mean? Many people think that's what caused more anger and identity crisis. The popular robot image of an automated society. So you've got to look at what the heck is he saying. He's saying something really different there. How can automation and cybernation can play an essential role? I see that. That's his using the computer to modulate sensory thresholds, which you don't take too seriously, but what else could automation cybernation be used for to smooth the transition?
No. We agree that the modulation of the senses is exactly the ground of his hope.
Yeah.
Where we disagree is what was meant by the modulation of the senses. You tend to take an extremely literal view. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
which I regard as sort of a Gutenbergian view.
Yeah,
and I take a electric view, simultaneous dynamic view.
So, what is that? What is your view? What is automation cybernation going to do? How does he make it be an art form in bringing it into society?
Well, first, according to McLuhan, everything is art.
Yeah.
Because everything is making.
Yeah.
So we can't take art literally either, right? Everything, at least in my reading of McLuhan, there is no literal anchor to anything. Everything is dynamic. Everything is subject to the flip of figure and ground. So what I see McLuhan as attempting to do is to set out the possibility of figure, the entire range of possibilities of figure ground flip. And then on the basis of that, understand the convulsions, the natural convulsions of history. and through that understanding, transform how we react to convulsions and how we go into convulsions in the first place.
So what I say about modulating the media environments is not a correct understanding based on what you're saying.
Yeah, I believe that you take it too literally.
Right. Why do you think he made it sound literal?
Well, I mean, as we've often discussed, I have to use words when I'm talking to you, right? So McLuhan was always caught in the problem that he couldn't say what he wanted to say because people were only on the way to being able to understand what he wanted to say. So he was always caught in the dilemma that in a certain way he had to speak to people's understandings, which automatically falsified what he was talking about, right? But if he didn't do that, he couldn't reach them, right? And that's the problem he had teaching his classes, and it's the problem he had talking, for example, on TV or radio. So his the whole thing that is interesting about McLuhan in my reading is that he was attempting to deal with an age-old problem here. It's a problem that Plato addressed as dialectic, right? How do words suddenly jump beyond themselves into a new understanding? And it's something that the Western tradition has never solved.
Have you come anywhere near solving it?
Well, I think once, it's not really a question of solving in the sense of, you know, having a puzzle and then you find the right answer. The solution, which could be taken almost in a chemical sense of dissolving a problem, right? Wittgenstein said that the way to address the way to get beyond philosophical problems, according to Wittgenstein, is to dissolve them as problems. And I see something similar going on in McLuhan and also in my understanding of McLuhan. And that is that the events of history, including the experience of individuals is always a foreground matter, and the what needs to be realized is that these foreground matters are humorous in a certain sense because they are inevitably alienated from ground. So we're all in the position of wearing masks. I mean, the chapter we're looking at is the global theater. We're all in the position of wearing masks and playing roles. And the difficulty of trying to understand these very profound problems of human life is to come to terms with this gap between the mask and the role that we're always playing, and the complete range of roles that are available to us. That's something that tragedy is born out of that, but also humor. And so it's the solution, if you will, is to ride the tragedy and the humor of that gap. And a lot of your work I see as doing that, right? You bring a sense of humor and remove to almost everything you do.
Right. So let me say this. So there is a harmony and a homeostasis, a balance happening in the world. Would that be the ground? So if Black Lives Matter starts, you encounter their, go to one of their meetings and they're all pissed off at white people, and you get them to calm down and you start laying out the visual space dynamics, the acoustic space, the tactile gap, and the electric extension, sort of lay out McLuhan's thing and present it as a almost like a poem. This is the balance. Your natural instincts have a great market, and it's usually seen in entertainment and music and that. Now, maybe some say, well, okay, you're just seeing us as the court jesters or something, court entertainment. Yeah, but that's your natural abilities as a race in your history makes you do these the content for Electromedia, which people want. You match that. Now, the Western white guys, men and women, they're good at accounting and managing and bureaucracy. They're stiff. So it starts to lay out the way populations around the world are balancing each other off, and then different media environments enhance in different situations, one tribe or one group's sensory characteristics versus another. And then you ultimately see how, look, everything's quite balanced. Resume what you're doing, be what you are, and understand how the machines are enhancing and maybe going to confuse so that you think that you're not appreciated on that level anymore and you need to do something else. So you sort of try to go to Yale and learn to play golf and become a white guy. Now, that's okay because industry needs people, no matter where they're from, to do the bureaucratic functions. But on top of that, everybody's being swamped by this onrushing future, onrushing threat. So you go on and present this scenario that we're in, and what people are agitated by are not the appropriate concerns, and they're actually balanced off. What do you think of that? Presenting, it's almost like presenting McLuhan's understanding as a poem, a painting of a harmonious situation. For example, like opera comes in when the high visual grading of the printing press needs a little bit more acoustic reality in the European culture. So they invent opera. It's a heightened up the acoustic. What do you think of that as a presentation of presenting the balance that's going on?
Well, from my point of view, the problem with that is that it's based on a bunch of literalisms.
Yeah.
Right? There's the black race, there's the white race, there's opera, there's books. all of these things are literalisms. It's as if we could go out in the world and we could point at a black person and say, oh yeah, here's this understanding of the world, and then point to a white person. Here's this other understanding of the world. But of course, it's nonsense because any particular black person may have a point of view that's completely different from another black person.
Yeah.
Number one, and number two, any person, myself included, and yourself included, has all sorts of different points of view in a single day or a single hour.
Yeah. Right?
So the ground of these things is extremely complicated, and when we attempt to deal with them through literalisms, that is the driver of the history, or the nightmare history from which we're trying to awake. Right? How do we allow deliteralisms, that is to say, the dynamic even of ground, the dissolution even of ground, how do we allow that and still retain things like individual human identity, privacy, order in society, etc.? And that's
okay. Hold
go
it.
Ahead.
So Eric, in his last public interview as the center was being closed in April 1980, was interviewed in the Toronto Star as son of McLuhan, and he said, I specialize in generalities. So McLuhan is dealing with generalities, which he felt was useful because he said the generality indicated by the term medium applied to a stretch of time, like 25 or 100 years. And we had so much new information about thousands of years back and speculation about thousands of years into the future that it's better to have these vast, quote, generalities about the media environments, and that helps us get perspective. So you're saying that I'm saying, because I'm using McLuhan generalities, Cameron, I've got to use generalities when talking to you.
Yeah.
So are you not using generalities, or how are you not being literal in your writing?
No, you're right. I mean, what you're pointing to is the problem
yeah.
of dialectic that was already seen by Plato, and doubtless it's all already been seen sort of forever in human history. The older people, the wiser people, had the problem of communicating with the younger people. And the whole great problem of communication is how do you engage somebody's limited understanding to take them beyond that limited understanding? And of course, that's a huge, huge problem. I'm not downplaying it, but the need, in my view, is not to get locked in that problem. The greater need, in my view, is to express what mature understanding comes to when it's at last born. Right? And those are two very different things, right? What is mature understanding, and how do you lead to mature understanding?
Okay, so, how about this suggestion? From mm-hmm. this point on, you be me, and I'll be you. And you say my line, and I'll say your line back to you. See what happens there.
Yeah.
Because
yeah,
we have said... We have said what we're saying right now in the first 20 minutes of this recording, what we've said many hundreds of times, and any person who's paying attention and listening to all our recordings should be fed up now. Well, we heard you guys. You say the same thing every show. We come up with different variations or wrinkles on the surface, which are interesting. But I was telling somebody or talking to somebody about this today or earlier. There is the view that... people never change. There's always fighting and wars and famine and fun celebrations. The cliches of human activities. So, quote, the conservative person says, well, that's always going to be the way it is. So I'm not going to open my borders. I'm going to have intelligence agencies to find out who's trying to topple America or whatever. And you understand defense and all the things that lightheaded people, airheads, think we should get rid of and all get along, which is a really simple thing, an unrealistic approach from this attitude of there are eternals. Now, McLuhan comes along and says, yeah, there sort of are eternals, but the way humans express these continuous repeating of problems, they don't learn from history, is they do it differently. At some point, especially in the last couple hundred years, there's a different material conditions, different meteorological environments that makes the eternal habitual condition responses of people to sort of surprise people and become through another way, show up differently. So you can look at the decided changes in the way people live their frustrating lives, and their up and down of their lives. And so I can take I call it the conservative view that there are these eternals, and I just always remember people are forced to be practical and don't get too highfalutin. And then a guy like McLuhan comes along and he talks to the point where people say, you sound like an utopian. How the hell is that going to happen? Humans are never going to change. But people have now, 50 years, 60 years later, said, holy shit, this world is completely different. I don't know if there's any eternities anymore. And if there aren't any more unchangeable human factors, then we're not human anymore, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
Something has, you could say, has tipped the scale to supporting the idea that people do change. And there are not eternal things. Eternal conditions.
But don't confuse two things. One is, do people change? And the answer to that is, of course, and McLuhan recognized that. And the other is the disappearance of eternals. And that's something that is also true and that had its roots back in the 19th century. And according to McLuhan and many other people like Heidegger say, actually had its roots back in Greece.
Yeah.
So that we can't confuse the fact of change with the disappearance of eternals. Those are completely different things, and need to be considered very carefully.
Would the eternals be the elements that you're pointing out in media dynamics, the new media science?
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. Let me read you a couple short quotes that you yourself have cited in this same chapter. One is from page 88, and there McLuhan says, "This pattern of non-lineality is evident in every human activity." That's from Take Today.
Yeah.
Quoted by Bob Dobbs on page 88. Then Bob Dobbs quotes McLuhan from 1961, The Humanities in the Electronic Age. This is from Dobbs, 96. Jet travel and satellite broadcasting will foster the grasp of languages, ancient and modern, in a simultaneous cultural transparency.
Right.
So in both of these things, McLuhan is talking about something that is eternal only in the sense of non-lineal and simultaneous.
Mm.
But in this sense of the eternal, there is a dynamic. It's not that everything is still and always remains the same. Instead, just like in the physical sciences, the physical world is completely dynamic and unstable, and we can never predict, you know, what one weather front is going to transform into, et cetera, et cetera. But the laws that are underneath those transformations, we can know and we can understand. And that's the same with McLuhan. It's not that there is no change. It's that we have to understand change. And when we understand change, then the whole world can change, right? Just as when we began to understand physical laws after Galileo and chemical laws after Lavoisier, when we understand these things, it changes everything. But what doesn't change is what the laws are expressing. So Galileo's laws are brand new, they're revolutionary, but they're the way the world is. And always has been and always will be.
Well, the
right, so that's,
the way the world is that people ignore the import of Galileo's laws, and they'll stick with religion or economics or drinking beer or something. You know, they don't.
Well, you
don't
say that, but we don't have a choice. What you're really saying is that we don't give in to the implications of law. And one of the things that McLuhan was most emphatic about is that we don't have a choice when it comes to the technological developments of physical laws. Physical laws which eventuate, for example, in automobiles or planes or something like this, those transform the world, and we do not have the choice of going back before Galileo and say, okay, now I'm going to live in the Renaissance. That doesn't work.
Do you think that the laws of media and the laws McLuhan laid out are way more important than the laws of science and whatever you call the activity of lawmaking of the last 500 years?
Well, they're more important to humans in the sense that if we end up destroying ourselves or even destroying the biosphere, then our failure to understand ourselves is going to override physical laws, unfortunately. Right? That's the the potential doom that we're headed towards. So the hope is that wisdom is going to prevail, and we're going to accommodate ourselves to the facts of the world, which include physical laws, but also psychological laws. And it was the latter. I mean, the laws of media are the laws of psychological dynamics.
And sociological dynamics?
Yes, but That's like saying that's the difference between chemistry and organic chemistry. Those two can be conceived differently, but they're intimately related. Organic chemistry is another sort of chemistry that begins with a complication beyond simple chemistry, and that's the same as psychology and sociology.
Psychology is more complicated?
No. Psychology is
the difference organic between, and simple chemistry or something you said. You
Both simple, well, if we, I don't think that the word simple necessarily goes with non-organic chemistry. They're both very, very complicated, and the more we know about them, the more we realize how complicated they are and how much we don't know about them. Mm. And that's what drives research forward. But it's not the case that chemistry and organic chemistry are the same. They have different foci. They have different ways of talking about their disciplines. So, and it's the same with psychology and sociology. The sociology, of course, is not entirely separate from psychology. It's just that psychology within sociology is very different from psychology considered on its own.
Well, when you talk about interior landscape, is that more psychology, or is there a collective interior landscape?
Yeah, there's both. That's why my blog is called McLuhan's New Sciences Plural.
Right. So, well, we should try to figure out how to talk about this differently.
Uh-huh. I agree with you. So yeah. If I don't think it was a bad suggestion saying that we could switch roles.
Yeah. Okay, because, anytime you want to do it, you know, you don't have to just keep start doing it and be it. You know, put me on. Suddenly become me. And I don't know when you're going to do it and say my stuff back to me.
Well, I mean, we'll make an attempt in the rest of our conversation here.
Yeah.
It's the, and the as I see it, one mask is science, that is to say, my mask is science, and your mask is the history of science. And those are two different things, but they're, of course, they're closely related.
Right, and your audience is literate at this point. You're not presenting yourself in other media. I present myself in post-literate media. Mainly. I don't write as much as you do. So there's a difference there. We're addressing different audiences or different media on the formal causality level, you know.
Well, at the level of attempted causality.
Yeah.
Right? I write not to a particular audience because I don't think I have any audience.
Right. So that's another dynamic there, Dialetti. You're isolated, and I'm not. So we present.
We could talk a little bit about what it is to be isolated, right? You can claim not to be isolated.
I think I have a bigger audience. If you say you don't have much of an audience, then I've got an audience.
Yeah, but there's a difference between having an audience and having people that understand what you're talking about. And in one sense, I would even argue that one of the great things about you is that you talk beyond what you yourself understand.
Yeah, that's right. I'm not literal.
Correct. Yeah, there you go. Now you're talking me.
Yeah. I'm simultaneous. You're literal. You're always defining words in your your column. Could we archetypalize each here? See, I'm complicated because I actually sell stuff that helps people, really helps them in a new way. You're not doing that. So I have that extra experience, which colors my understanding of McLuhan. I'm a different person in relation to McLuhan now than 30 years ago. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And not just in terms of aging or something. I'm engaged in something that's fantastic. And I think I told you Rothschild emailed me, right? Oh, yeah, you heard that. You know, that was pretty interesting. And there's follow-ups to that. So now you could say, well, he's just another guy. Okay, he's got a lot of money, so what? Or he's got this history, and he advises the queen, and she's the head of a religion, so she's supposedly important. But a part of our society today is really, literally, people are not listening to each other. They're not listening to anything, to any institution. Or they're determined to act that way, right? They're listening, they're watching, processing information, but they're not acknowledging that they're going to be obedient to anything they hear about.
Right, because ground has disappeared. It's become evident to everybody what was evident to only a few, 100 or 200 years ago, namely that ground has dissolved.
Yes, and that quote about 1965 that McLuhan says, the average person or the electronic angel cannot get hypnotized by a medium like as happens in slower societies, because there's too many medium. He's hopping from one to another, so he's forever outside, alienated, or not falling into and accepting the conditioning of a certain environment. And he saw that's a service. That's good. So we have, and this has been going on since 65, he hyped up even more, so that we have arrived at some kind of collective super civilized subatomic man. We're super civilized, super detached, super involved. But things catch us unawares, and all of a sudden we're in the middle of a street and we're walking down and somebody shoots us. You know? Mm-hmm. That's increasing.
Well, now, McLuhan would never use the word super without knowing that that has to do with what is above, what is
supra.
Supra, any word like that has to do with what's above.
Yeah.
And so then you get into a satellite environment and you get into alienated mind. That's alienated from ground. So being super civilized means that you exist in a complex cultural situation where that very complexity has dissolved the ground of each and every component culture within that complexity. And that's where we are.
So when you say there's no ground, there's no technological underpinning?
No, there's no. Let's remember.
Is that too literal?
When science understands something, right? Science always comes to understand something in history, right? So when Galileo understands physical laws, he does so at a certain point in history. But the physical laws that he understands do not have a history. They are the way things are, right? Or they have a history only in the sense that, you know, ultimately they relate back to the birth of the universe and the Big Bang and all that sort of stuff. So they have a very complex history, you could say. But for normal purposes, they have no history.
Yeah.
So when people lose their sense of ground, for McLuhan, what's going on there is itself an expression of ground.
Yeah.
So what McLuhan would say is, look, I can dance or I can feel fine on top of all of these personal, familial, societal, cosmopolitan changes that are going on at every second. And what I would like to teach you is this ability to dance on top of these changes.
Mm. Yeah, the image of the surfer in at the end
Correct.
Of the medium is the massage.
Correct. Correct.
And he failed at that.
Yes, he did. But it's a great failure, right?
Let's go into what is the audience of the failure? What's the environment? Because many people will say, I got some insight from McLuhan. He communicated something to me, you know. There's all these...
yeah. Congratulations.
Eccentric. Well, no, they what do people need? Poise. If something gives them poise, then they've got poise, then you can't argue about how they got there. They got there, and it worked. And some people got that from McLuhan.
If you go down that road, then you have to say that if the goal is poise, then anybody who has poise has sort of got it, right? So if you have your poise as a member of a country club, or if you have your poise as a member of a teenage gang, or if you have your, right? I mean, there's many, many, many different ways of having poise, and most of them are ways of ignoring the wider context.
Yeah.
Most of them are a way of saying, I'm going to put my feet here and forget about all the rest.
Right, and McLuhan, he was quite straightforward about it. He says, I'm into suffering. His poise didn't mean he avoided suffering.
Correct. Correct.
You know, I think he called that maybe a Christian thing.
Yeah, well, I think it was. But remember that sometimes McLuhan would say, oh, I don't have any problems. I've never suffered about anything, right?
Yeah.
I mean, and so it would depend upon his audience. It would depend upon what he was trying to convey.
Yeah.
But McLuhan certainly saw the problem that we're talking about, and that is that you can't overstress either side. You can't overstress the suffering, and you can't overstress the poise.
Right, or the happiness.
There has to be the balance that we have been talking about since you brought up the topic of balance 15 or 20 minutes ago, is a problematic balance, because it's a balance that doesn't overlook the cultural and the psychological problems that are involved in balance.
Yeah, When he talks to Nina Sutton, he tends to do the dismissing. Well, no, I've never been depressed, never been unhappy. He's saying those issues that people are concerned about, their private conscience, are trivial to what he's looking at. And they're so huge or so involving or so profound, it's beyond emotion. It doesn't. You don't
right.
have happiness in relation to that or sadness.
Right, but he also says in the same long conversation, that's actually conversations, with Nina, he also says that when at the University of Manitoba he first began to look into I.A. Richards and Eliot and all of these people, everything fell apart.
Yeah.
And he says, I thought it was the end of everything. So... here's this guy saying, I have no problems, and also saying, I was completely lost, and the whole great question is, how do those work together, right?
Yeah, but let's look at that. So, yeah, he was completely lost, but he wasn't running around, neurotically shoplifting to distract himself or something. He just sat there looking at the horror and the abyss, and, very quiet.
Right.
You wouldn't even know he was noticing it. There's that level of lewd getting lost. You know what I mean?
Right. So I forget where, but recently I was reading something in McLuhan where he talks about the highbrow solution and the acting out solution.
Oh, yeah?
And he says that the highbrow solution is very, very difficult and is impossible for most people. But, of course, that was his solution,
yeah,
the highbrow, to say, well, through... very esoteric education, it's possible to reach this balance. But he says for most people, if there's this acting out, there's this, I don't know what you'd call it, finding practical solutions from
he called it reacting. He said people were reacting rather than acting, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
He said Burroughs was reacting.
Right. But reacting and acting, they're both subject to psychological laws or the laws of media.
Yeah.
Right? So it's not as if, when he says I don't use value judgments, if he says that people are reacting, he's not saying, oh, that's bad. He's saying go through your reaction to understand how it came about. Right, retrace the perception, as he would say.
Yeah, retrace the stages of apprehension.
Yeah. Correct. So everything, in a certain sense, is apprehension, and the trick is to understand the stages whereby it came to be.
Yeah. Now, it just occurred to me, you never got to hang out with McLuhan. The way he was, just hanging out with people, it was interesting.
Right. Well, remember, I did meet him, and our meeting was not particularly happy.
Right, so you're yourself.
Well, no, I also participated in graduate seminars, a couple of graduate seminars in the afternoons.
Yeah. In the restaurants, walking down the street.
Yeah, I never did that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know, I didn't spend days and days and days, like George Thompson, would work with him every day. But I did spend time with him a lot of different places outside of the coach house. And I could have been projecting it, but I always felt that this guy was observing. Man, was he watching. You know what I mean? I felt like it was a big telescope I was walking beside. You know what I mean? Maybe
yeah.
Because he was tall. But there, it was emanating some kind of observing, and this could have been all my projections of knowing I'm thinking things that he said, and I'm thinking about him saying, well, maybe I'll ask him about this, I'm lost in his big statements, so to speak, and so I think he's in the same way, but it's pretty hard to get inside someone else, see what they're feeling as they're walking along, other than surface things, but my memory of it is... there was almost not a body there. It was an intelligence, an awareness I was walking beside. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
I didn't even notice what clothes he was wearing or anything.
Right. So that's one
How
way
How about you
to...
hung out with Thomas Kuhn? Was it like that with him?
Well, I wouldn't call it hung out with.
You could hang out with anybody.
Number one, he wasn't the sort of guy that anybody could hang out with. No
right.
way.
Well, did you hang out with anybody? You didn't, of this kind of stature. You just were students in relation to them.
No, I wouldn't say that. I mean, for example, with Professor Gadamer, we were just good friends. He was always the professor, and I was always the student in the sense of giving way before his opinions and never arguing with him or something like that. But we were good friends, sat around in his office and had some drinks and had some laughs and just enjoyed each other's company.
And where was that?
I was in Heidelberg. In Germany.
Yeah, you're talking about, what is he known for, communitarianism?
Hermeneutics. Sorry?
Communitarianism, right? Isn't that the label for him? He's a communitarian?
Maybe. I mean, that certainly is not a mislabeling, but he was an expert in hermeneutics.
Right.
He was an expert in, he wrote extremely... influential and deep books on Plato, on Aristotle, on Hegel. He was a personal friend and student of Heidegger.
Yeah.
So, he knew Derrida very well. He debated Derrida in French.
Yeah.
McLuhan was an amazing guy. Gadamer. Gadamer and I always spoke in German because by the time I knew him, he was already 90.
Right.
And he remained very cogent until he was 101.
Well, what years are these for you? Where are you? How old are you?
When I met Gadamer, I was 45.
So this is in the 80s?
Yeah, at the end of the 80s I met him.
Why were you over there? Were you a student?
No. I had been a student, but in the late 1980s, I decided that I had to know much more about Heidegger, and that meant that I had to learn German in a different way from what I knew before. And so I began to spend much more time in Germany and with ordinary people, and especially in Messkirch, which was where Heidegger was born and where he's now buried. So I got to know Messkirch very well, and I got to know all kinds of people in Messkirch.
Yeah, you didn't live there for 2 or 3 years. These are vacations, right?
Yeah, but I would go for a couple months at a time.
How did you do that? Because you were freelancing? You weren't in a regular salary job?
Yeah, well, my whole life I've had jobs that I could continue to do my main work, which was my writing and my reading.
Right, so you had autonomy. The kind of employment
Yes.
you had, would you make sure that's what it was? So, all right, so you spent many times with Gadamer. Because I used
Yes.
to think that you went to, philosophical symposia in Europe. And
yes,
probably,
I did. And I spent some summers doing that, but then I stopped doing that in favor of spending more time in Germany and with people like Gadamer.
And you would attend classes of Gadamer's?
Oh, no. Gadamer really didn't have regular classes by the time he was 90. He had been, retired sometime in his 60s, I guess, and then he began to teach in Canada and the United States. So typical story for Canada, when Gadamer first retired, he came over and taught at McMaster.
Mm-hmm.
And then the stupid people in McMaster basically kicked him out. He wanted to stay at McMaster and would have been happy to stay at McMaster for years and years and years. But no, they got rid of him. And so then he went down and started teaching at Boston College. And
Where's that? Boston.
Boston College.
Oh, Boston College.
Yeah,
yeah. They said Boston. Boston College. So, and they kicked him out of there?
No, no. He continued there as long as he wanted to.
So what basis did McMaster do that? Kick him out?
Well, I'm sure it was a financial decision. I used to have, and probably still have somewhere, some papers on this. I wouldn't be able to locate them now.
Yeah.
If I ever find them again, it'll just be happenstance. But I remember seeing some discussion of Gadamer getting booted out of McMaster. Maybe there's even stuff online.
Mm.
But people, there were people that at McMaster were saying, "What are you doing? This is the smartest guy we have at our faculty. You have to be idiots to get." No, we're going to get rid of him.
This is Canada, right?
Canadians did that with Jill Soane in Toronto. They did it with, there's, that you could create an all-star team of great intellects that were in Canada, and they got booted out either by their own institutions or by the Canadian Revenue Authority by raising their taxes so high that they couldn't stay.
Right.
Eric Havelock is another guy. He got literally booted out of Canada.
Well, let's say a modern one is Dr. Carolyn Dean.
Well,
the great physician, the greatest doctor in Canada. She got booted out indirectly. She left. And then while she was away, they said, fuck you, and they booted her out. She wasn't even there anymore. Go ahead.
The brain drain out of Canada is just colossal. And Canadians just sort of go along their merry way supplying it. I mean, look at hockey players, for example.
Yeah.
Hockey players just got exported from Canada, and eventually the United States national team had sons of players that had been on the Canadian national team.
Yeah.
And that sort of thing happened over and over and over again in the intellectual history of Canada / United States.
Yeah.
So Kenneth Galbraith, for example, and, you know, it just so many people. Alexander Graham Bell, another example.
Do you, Arthur Croker, I just finished his latest book, he makes a big deal out of Canada. He believes in, there's some services to the Canadian temperament and features, whatever, Canadianness, that he says are worth preserving, and he sort of is trying to create an intellectual center based on the Toronto School, he would say, and you know, he would be the, quote, head of it. And but would you say that may not be possible in Canada anymore?
Oh, I hope it is possible. I completely agree with Croker that it's something that should be done. On the other hand, when I got in touch with Croker and said, listen, I'll come up to Victoria and try to understand more about these goals of yours, with which I agree, he said, oh, no, I'm too busy. I can't talk to you. And, what kind of Canadianism is that?
Yeah, when did this happen? I never knew this.
Yeah, well, I think didn't something similar happen with you? Didn't?
Oh, yeah.
If I
Croker, so, Croker ignores me as any opportunity he can get.
Yeah. But
when did this happen to you? When were you interested in Croker?
Oh, this would have been in the 90s, maybe.
Before me and Marx met you? Before 98?
I really don't know. Probably in the 1995, 2005 decade,
right?
In there. But I, off the top of my head, I can't specify it further.
What were you reading? Do you have any particular books that struck you?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. I like the stuff that he was doing back in the 1980s.
Yeah.
You like his stuff on panic and things falling apart and all that sort of stuff.
You like McLuhan in his Grant.
Yeah.
And the postmodern scene. It talks about Augustine.
I like his long essay on Charles Cochrane.
Yes, I was just going to say that. Yeah, he adds Cochrane and McPherson to the Toronto School. You know, guys, Logan, they don't do that. They don't know it.
Yeah. And I agree with him very much on that.
Right. So
I think they're important people in the Toronto School.
Right. So the that's very interesting. Now, it's timely that we bring this up now because I just read Croker, and I'm going to start doing a series. I'm going to go through his book with, you know, Clinton and them in office hours, and we did it today. It'll pile up the hours, and then I'm going to send it to Arthur. You know, it'll be 50 hours on his book or something. I don't know really how long it'll be, but it'll be, you know, more than 3 hours. So that's very interesting that I didn't know you had a familiarity with Croker and that you had looked at him and actually wanted to go and hang out with him. What were you proposing that you live there He wouldn't have to pay you or anything, but you'd be hanging out with his scene, right?
No. Okay. I wasn't proposing that I live there. First, you have to understand that most of my family lives in the Vancouver area.
Oh.
In those days, my sister and brother-in-law and nieces lived in Victoria. And
wow.
So I used to go to Victoria all the time anyway. And so what I said to Coker is, look, I'm very interested in your work, especially your work on Cochrane and Innes and Grant and these people. So next time I'm in Victoria, what I would like to do is make an appointment and come by and speak to you. Oh, no, I'm far too busy.
That's crazy.
Yeah, that's Canadianism for you.
I don't know what. Right? No, that's Croker. But how is that Canadian?
No. But what I'm saying is, it's there. What's very Canadian is somebody has an idea about Canada, and it's an idea about communalism and being a good person and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And then you say, "Oh, great! That's I agree with you completely. Let's have a communal meeting." Oh no! I can't do that.
Jeez, that's ridiculous. But that's Croker.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the last time I was going to be coming over and take a chance to drop in, oh, no, Mary Louise's mother is dying. We have to deal with her mother. He is scraping the barrel for excuses, you know.
Yeah.
He's not a doctor. What are they? Maybe they have to nurse her or something or hang around her, but that was his last alibi.
But in my case, he didn't even bother to say that there was any kind of excuse. He simply said, no, I don't have the time to talk to people, something like that. And then you have to say, well, you know, he's got this center,
yeah,
and he's working with these students. You know, how can you work with people if you don't talk to them and meet with them?
Deal with the effects of other people being interested. I mean, that's what McLuhan was good at that. He met all kinds of people. You back in the early 70s, you go to his coach house, man, it was packed all the time of strangers wanting to talk to him, you know?
Yeah. But
feel harassed, but he did it. So Coker's like you. he writes for himself, but all of a sudden it got out there and people responded. Oh, no, I'm just doing this for myself.
Mm-hmm. But I would, I may be isolated, and I think far more isolated in one sense than Croker. I mean, Croker's famous and gets awards and travels around the world.
Yeah.
People tell him how smart he is, none of which is true of me. But
right.
On the other hand, if anybody wants to speak to me or meet with me or go for a beer with me or something, I have no problem with that.
And you'll make time for them. Nothing's going to get in the way of that.
Of course.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty funny. You know, is there something peculiar about Canada? Remember McLuhan used to say that Canada had a philosophical relationship to the global theater because they live right beside its efficient engine, America. So they had
mm-hmm.
a close-up view of it. They're like a neighbor, so they hear all the fights in the middle of the night, but they are not part of it. So their sons don't have to go to Vietnam and all that crisis. So they can...
Well, that was in the old days. Now they're over in Ukraine.
Yeah.
Wearing American flags and American ideas.
Yeah, did you hear about that?
Canada sold itself out long ago.
Yes. Did you... somebody was telling me this tonight. The Canadian general was holed up with the Nazis in Mariupol, or whatever, how you ever say that, and he tried to escape and got caught by the Russians. Now he's in Moscow, a high Canadian general.
Yeah, nobody quite knows if that's what the story is there. That's more at the level of rumor.
Right, and he got kicked out of the Canadian Navy, Army, whatever he was in. He's a renegade.
The amazing thing about that story, which isn't a rumor, is that he actually got named the head of the Canadian Armed Forces and then had to resign.
And we don't know why he had to resign.
No, we do. We do. There were reports of sexual misconduct at Royal Roads.
The eternal verities, the eternal causes.
That's right, that's right. But I believe the stories had to do with Royal Roads. And the interesting thing about that is that we're talking about Croker in Victoria, and Royal Roads is in Victoria.
We can't get out of B.C. tonight. And then we find out you go there, you live there, and it's sort of indirectly through your relatives.
That's right. Well.
And why are they there? You guys all came from Regina, right?
Yes, but my sister, whose birthday it is today, by the way, 19. Yeah. My sister married a great guy up in Kitimat, British Columbia, which is up north, by the what used to be called the Queen Charlotte Islands, close to the border with Alaska, actually.
Yeah.
And so they lived up there for many years, and I used to visit them there regularly. And on one particularly happy occasion, we went out to the Queen Charlotte's and had a highly interesting 2 weeks out there exploring the islands. So then eventually they moved from Kitimat down to Vancouver Island. And, of course, I continued to visit them there. And then they moved over to Vancouver because both of their daughters were employed in Vancouver.
Mm.
And that's where they live now. So that's one side of my family. And then another sister also lives in Vancouver. So I have a brother in Calgary, but and his boys also live in Calgary. Mm. But the rest of my family is all in Vancouver.
Okay. So McLuhan says in that 1970 CBC interview, I remember seeing it, I think that's one of the first times he said the TV generation, the baby boomers, were wandering gypsy scholars. That's me and you. I didn't know that about you, but we're wandering gypsy scholars. We go all over the place.
Uh-huh. I'd agree with that.
Yeah.
So yeah. And wandering gypsy scholars actually is one characterization of everybody.
Yeah.
You could think of Ulysses with Bloom and Stephen wandering around the city.
Yeah.
They're wandering in completely different ways, and they sort of crisscross each other at different points. But they are both wanderers.
Yeah.
And what is it to wander? As Joyce shows in Ulysses, you can conceive wandering as different ideas sort of sparking all the time, right?
Yeah.
And so instead of wandering being something through space or even through time, you can conceive of wandering as what the human subject, the human individual, does through time and space. They spark different ideas. And that sparking is what human being is all about.
Yeah. And and you're not necessarily moving. So you and I we spend a lot of time by ourselves sedentarily studying visual space or bouncing off visual space if we're using books and that and reading. And we do it with not much any peer pressure. We're not in any organization where you got to perform. So that's the ideal way to be. We're doing the most fun way to learn or to experience.
But I wouldn't say that, at least in my case, and I believe also in your case, I wouldn't say that there's no pressure to perform. It's just that the context in which we wish to perform is not a defined context.
It's not a paid situation.
Correct. So anytime you have a defined context, it's not terribly difficult to perform.
Yeah.
because the rules are set. It's like playing a card game or something.
Yeah.
But when you remove the rules of performance and you say, okay, now let's see how you can perform absent rules. Now you're talking about something that's difficult.
And what's an example of that?
Well, I mean, I would say that that's what we do, you and I. And what many people have done throughout history. And the reason that is done by some people in society is that ultimately death and sickness and craziness and war, these things destroy context. And so human society is dependent upon wanderers, people that go beyond defined context,
yeah,
to redefine and to retrieve human solidarity in the face of these recurrent collapses.
Yeah, that would be it, living without ground or noticing the ground and how it changes, not identifying,
yeah,
holding on to any ground, yeah, changes.
Yeah, or seeing that ground is something that it's not like literal earthly ground. It's something that has to do with death, has to do with collapse, has to do with meaninglessness. So it's a very difficult kind of ground, but it's what human maturity comes to terms with.
Right. So let's go to 97.
yeah, we haven't gone too far.
Yeah, you distracted me with those earlier quotes, and don't know why what you were illustrating, but it was relevant within the minutes of the
Sunday. I was illustrating the fact that McLuhan was ultimately not interested in history or in lineality. He was,
yeah,
interested in what's below that.
But he would write to put things into a lineal order, half, maybe one-third lineal order. You know, when you're writing, mm-hmm, you're doing linearity.
That's right. So there's nothing. McLuhan wasn't saying that there is no change. He was saying there is change, and the point is to understand it. So, in physical science, it would be ridiculous to say, I'm doing chemistry, but I don't have anything to do with physical materials. That's nuts. And
yeah,
so similarly with McLuhan. McLuhan, of course, was very interested in change and in history and all that sort of stuff. What he was trying to show is that there are laws to these changes that we can understand.
Right, so that's right what I was reading into. Now at 69, you've had a lot of convulsive changes that McLuhan's referring to. There were hardly any convulsive changes in 65, but in 69 there were. Americans had been traumatized and shocked. There's a book called 1968, and the author documents what satellite TV, which came in that year, did to people. Then I bring in a McLuhan quote. Playboy says, how? And McLuhan says, probably about how he'd do the services of the automation. So he said that, mm-hmm, the computer can be used to direct a network of global thermostats to pattern life in ways that will optimize human awareness. Already, it's technologically feasible to employ the computer to program societies in beneficial ways. Playboy, how do you program an entire society beneficially or otherwise? So then I come in with the blue bob and oral commentary. This is the time in the 60s when people are thinking they're free. They aren't interested in being programmed. That's like fascism. Norden can't believe what McLuhan's saying. McLuhan's pushing this programming. McLuhan's very detached when he's saying it. He proclaimed it, and people read it and exclaimed, quote, there's a cold tone to McLuhan that's frightening. This guy is so nuts. He's trying to turn Orwell into an art form as if it's acceptable. I just made that up, right? But I heard, mm-hmm, approximate complaints like that. And then,
oh, sure,
I'd say, and McLuhan knew that he was having that effect. It was the level of a satire. But he was pointing out really what was happening. The economy was programmed by the banks at that point. People didn't have any updated thinking mechanism for it. They didn't have any models for the coming virtual economy, virtual in quotes.
Right.
So then now we quote McLuhan.
Yeah, but let's go over this because this is important and complicated stuff. I mean, when you talk about the economy having laws and being run
programmed
by banks, then that's a kind of model for how McLuhan saw human society.
Yeah.
But it's not the case that we knew the laws or the programs that were running everything. What McLuhan is saying is that there are these laws and these programs, and the only way to go about dealing with all of these changes is to understand these laws and programs, but he didn't know what they were. What he was advocating was the research and the probing and the investigation that would reveal those laws.
Well, he eventually tried to make some laws, but he was willing to them not to be understood, or people didn't realize the importance of them. You know, the tetrad and that. So maybe he felt he had to come up with something. So he came up with it. And it's not bad.
I agree with that.
Yeah, and he's nobody's really tackling it, coming up with anything better. Maybe the problem is how do you implement them, other than just personal awareness of that.
I think it's more difficult than that. It's not the tetrad is not the answer to life problems. The tetrad is an example of how complicated every single idea is.
Yeah, but that's what you're asking for, understanding the laws.
That's right. But if we think about chemistry and organic chemistry and zoology and genetics, all this sort of stuff, the science has very many different disciplines to it. And it would be a huge mistake if we were to say, okay, we understand something about chemistry, so we're going to apply those chemical laws literally to, let's say, medicine. That wouldn't work because medicine has a completely different focus from straight chemistry. It's a doctor needs to know some chemistry, but a doctor needs to know a great deal of other stuff beyond chemistry. And similarly here, it's to say, okay, there's the tetrad, and that shows the complications there are to any single idea. That may be true, but you can't just take the tetrad and say this is the answer to world history. That's ridiculous.
So you bring in other meme systems, which is what I do on my chart. I rotate through.
Okay. Yeah, I agree. I agree completely with that.
Yeah.
Yeah. The chart is a example of just how complicated things are.
Yeah.
Once you go from individual psychology to collective psychology to sociology, et cetera, et cetera. It's very, very complicated, but we can see from the physical sciences that it's entirely possible. Right, so McLuhan's around 1958, when McLuhan first uses the phrase "the medium is the message," what he's come to see is that there is a kind of basic focus that we can use in understanding human events. But almost immediately, that is to say, 59-60. He also understands that human beings are inevitably involved in complex associations that are far bigger and in a sense more determinative than their individual psychologies.
Yeah.
So he realized right in that period, 50 to 60, is where that's the great kind of focal point.
You mean 1950 or 59 to 60?
No, 58 to 60, yeah. Those
right.
2 years.
Yeah.
That's when McLuhan's most important ideas, most important in his valuation, his most important ideas occurred to him in that 2 year period. And the crazy thing is that his brain broke as a result of those
those discoveries.
That's right.
Yeah, his brain broke. So he did become lost physically in those instances.
He had blackouts.
Yeah.
Right? He had literal blackouts, which was a symbolic representation of sort of the implication of his ideas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Kroger's book is talking about the ablated consciousness, the blackout that's happening to everybody.
Yeah. And there you go.
And I've told you my pattern, you know, since the late 40s, anytime a new technology came in, McLuhan got sick.
Yeah.
He got affected by it.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting if he was being affected by it because he was on the bleeding edge and was picking up on what's going on, like we imagine artists are. They're sensitive to the trauma of the change.
That's right, like a radar station, a
dew
line.
And so in that way, McLuhan was the
And
most...
by the way, that's when he started dew line, wasn't it? Or no, or
no, no dew line 68.
69, yeah.
No, sorry. Summer of 68, July 68,
yeah.
First
mm-hmm.
issue.
Mm-hmm. But 10 years later than when I was talking about. Yeah.
But if you're looking at someone who's a, quote, artist or scientist who's accomplishing things
mm-hmm.
but breaking down, they're probably different artists were like that, you know, great artists. But that's a sign McLuhan makes a shortlist as one of the greater artists of his time because he was getting affected. He was feeling it,
mm-hmm.
you know, psychosomatic or collectosomatic. He was picking up
right.
on the collective.
That's a crutch that people like to use, right? I have great insight because I'm being affected deeply by
Well, you could say McLuhan was genuinely being affected because he didn't act out cliche neuroses that are familiar for people to pretend they're sick. He was doing ridiculous things like a Dr. Strangelove salute while blacking out, right? So he was really being affected. You don't do that when you try to get attention for your sensitivities. You don't push the envelope. You try to make it able that people can understand you and believe you. But he was not believable what he was going through.
uh-huh. Yeah, that's right. So that goes back to what we were saying a minute ago about being a radar station.
The antenna, Pound's quote, antenna.
That's right, being the antenna of the race. People that are sensitive in that sense are indeed great weather vanes.
Yeah.
For the race, and they act out what it is that they need to understand.
Yeah, that's the great thing about Thiel's writing on McLuhan. He knows that about McLuhan and says it. Says McLuhan was responding to the changes, you know, like a weather vane, an antenna, whereas most people who his colleagues in the universities and that, whoever read him, they say, oh, he was a, you know, Johnny come lately, he showed up, he disappeared. Not a great weather vane, you know what I mean? But Don Thiel saw that. He knew the significance of McLuhan.
But I didn't know Don like you did. I met him personally, but I thought that... Don thought that this side of McLuhan was suspicious.
No.
Right? Isn't that the side of McLuhan that he calls schizophrenic?
No, he calls it schizoid. And he pointed out to me, no problem saying schizoid. It's a slang term. It's not even the disease of schizophrenia. He's puzzling to people. He seems to contradict himself, which I then developed into quadriphenia. I go further than Don. I accuse McLuhan of quadriphenia. No, it's schizoid.
Right.
But no, Don really understood McLuhan, and he was not
Do you think so? I didn't dislike Dawn at all, but I've known an awful lot of very, very smart people in my time.
What kind of people?
Smart.
Smart people, okay.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
People like Kuhn at Princeton, or Rorty at Princeton, or Gadamer lately, John O'Neill, I believe, was a brilliant guy.
At York University?
At York University, yeah. Dawn did not have a brilliant mind in that sense. He wasn't somebody that in conversation, would come up with surprising ideas or something.
Well, he was thoughtful. You see, he was the only guy who could have really in-depth understanding conversations about McLuhan and get really subtle about what we're saying, like we do. There was nobody else around that you could do that, and he would not fly his ego at you. He'd listen to you, and then he'd maybe suggest, well, what about this part? I mean, it was great conversation, and his wife told me that he loved my conversation with him. He was always excited by him. And so that, you can't deny that. He's brilliant and smart as far as my experience of him,
Right. Oh, yeah. Well, I'm not trying to say that I know the truth about the man. All I know about him is the conversation I had with him and his wife over a long lunch one day in New York. So it's and I know people that worked with Don at Trent. Yeah, so that's all, my experience of the man.
Did you know that Don regretted the direction his life led him to, the presidency? He said, I went for power, and that was a mistake. Not many people admit that. I think that's pretty commendable.
Anybody that has any intelligence at all knows that life is... sort of wandering from one mistake to another.
Yeah. So he told me a lot of personal things that happened to him up there in Trent. It wasn't great. That's when he resigned in 87 or so. He said, that's it. And he got Stuart Brand's book, The Media Lab, and he read that, and he said, oh, they're using McLuhan down there. They talk about Joyce and McLuhan. And that gave him his big idea about fitting his way is the key to postmodern culture that he started to write about and became quite well known in the early 90s. Just before the internet, he had a flash like McLuhan did, say, in the mid 50s, before his real fame. But Don did that.
But that's kind of a crazy flash to have, right? I mean, here at the very time that McLuhan was, or that Thiel was working with McLuhan, was the time when McLuhan was most involved with Finnegan's Wake as sort of the key to, addressing the world, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
And so here's Thiel, how many years later? That was, let's say that was 53. And so he's... 35 years later, they all say, oh, I got this great idea about Finnegan's Wake and McLuhan and society.
No, like he was always writing essays on Finnegan's Wake and McLuhan all the way through, but nobody cared. The Joyceans didn't understand his emphasis on McLuhan. What he did, when he saw Stuart Brand, he said, I can put on the world. I got a way to put them all on. I'll get attention. And I'll get to do what I want to do rather than being a bureaucrat in a university office. And that's what he did. He found a way to put them on, and which McLuhan did. Same way.
Yeah.
Many different times, probably. So, no, he'd been building up his case for decades on all the essays. I have them all that he was writing. And they were building on the insights he got with Marshall in the early 50s, doing Finney's Wake together. I mean, they had a Finney's Wake reading group.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
So,
Bob, let me, just for a second here, I'm going to be setting out some food for the dog.
Okay.
So there'll be a strange noise, but I'll be right back with you in a sec.
Okay, you're doing that right now?
Yeah, right this second
okay.
as we speak.
Okay, go ahead.
He's up and he's hungry, and I have to give him first place here.
Yeah, he must feed the beast.
That's all right, that's done.
Yeah, no, I noticed Thiel's writing, when he did his book, the review, what is it, The Virtue of McLuhan, people didn't get it. And reviewers said, well, this guy is reacting to McLuhan personally. He's got a vendetta and all this. Maybe Don didn't express it well, but having discussed that dilemma, or his issues with McLuhan for many times, I knew what he was talking about. So I didn't think he didn't have a personal vendetta or anything or wound. He said, no, we got to deal with this. And he said, basically, McLuhan simplified Finnegan's Wake too much. And so Don said, I've got to get back. We're going to redo Finnegan's Wake and apply it to the digital culture to get out of the cul-de-sac that McLuhan had gotten people with, if they even got into Finnegan's Wake. But because he was dealing with a highbrow approach to McLuhan, Finney's Wake was the key, so he had to talk about it. So he said, okay, McLuhan has some insights here, but we've got to get back to Finney's Wake and go through it again and look at the media levels of it without getting trapped by McLuhan's reductionism. Then one could say, well, McLuhan was putting on the public and kept it simple. So I'm sure Don had that issue about, well, how well am I communicating, he would say. Mm-hmm. I'm not getting anywhere. If McLuhan screwed up here and there, I'm screwing up, which he never said that blatantly, but he was frustrated by the situation of what McLuhan had created, and he was trying to build on it. So anyways, I give Thiel a lot of credit for the way he, what he did. And yeah, he was a quiet guy, but he knew everybody in Canadian culture, and he mingled more than McLuhan did in the 50s and 60s. He'd be the representative of McLuhan out there in the art world, you know, in Arts Canada magazine, all that, where people wanted to talk to McLuhan, but he wouldn't be around, so they'd talk to Don. So Don knew everybody in all the worlds. And he was a great friend of the National Film Board founder from Britain who did the propaganda in the world in World War II, John somebody. Who's the famous NFB guy, well, famous documentary man in England that took over the NFB, came to Montreal. Well, John was there and spent a lot of time hanging out with him and got ill because of it. You had to drink a lot hanging out with this guy. And so eventually it screwed up some of Don's innards, and he had to go to the hospital in 70 or so. And that's when he wrote The Meat of His Rearview Mirror while he was in the hospital. Otherwise, he never would have done it. He wasn't interested in writing a book on McLuhan. But a friend suggested it, and he thought, well, I'm not doing anything laid up here, so let's see what we can do. But who's the famous NFB guy? You don't know who I mean, eh? Let's see.
No. Well, there wasn't Norman McLaren?
No, he's a maker of animation. This is a thinker. John, let's see, you put in John NFB director. I'll just say director. See what that comes up with.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you'll get it.
No, not yet. Just a second. Here's a list. Dennis Arkand. Going to Norman McLaren. There's a lot of them, but not the guy I'm looking for. Just keep going here. Nope, doesn't come up. So I'm going to put in legendary NFB people. Early NFB creators. John Grierson. That's the guy.
Okay, yeah. Uh-huh.
You know that name?
Yes.
Yeah, he 1898 to 1972. So he and Don get together. They get sick. Don survives. John dies because of their camaraderie. Grierson was a pioneering Scottish documentary maker, often considered the father of British and Canadian documentary film. In 1926, Grierson coined the term documentary in a review of Robert Flaherty's Mona. Is that the guy who did the Eskimo thing? Yeah, Nanook. He's the guy who did Nanook. You remember that? Carpenter talks about Flaherty. So, let's see. World War One. He was sent to the wireless telegraphy station at Altby Cromarty in 1916 as an ordinary telegraphist, but was promoted to telegraphist in June, and then he became a telegraphist on a minesweeper. So he's working with telegraphy. The next day he joined, he does this.
What was the first place that you said he was sent to?
Altby Cromarty. Was that Ireland or something? Let's see. No
idea.
Scotland. Cromarty is Scottish Gaelic. Yeah, it's in Cromarty County or something. No, I'm saying Cromarty is in the Highland area of Scotland.
Yeah. And so that was probably had to do with
Marconi.
The telegraph cable that went over to the Maritimes.
Yeah. And so he's at the end of the war. He walked away from his time in the Navy with a British War Medal and the Victory Medal. Then he joins the Fabian Society, the Socialists, in 1919, but it dissolved in 21. And he did the Critics Club. He had poetry published. He received a Rockefeller Fellowship in 1923 to study in the United States at the University of Chicago. That's where, you know, he'd run across Robert, the guy that McLuhan and Innes talk about, Robert somebody at the University of
Chicago. Park.
Who? Park, right, Park, yeah. And later at Columbia, his research focus was the psychology of propaganda, the impact of the press, film, and other mass media on forming public opinion. He was particularly interested in the popular appeal and influence of the yellow tabloid press and the influence and role of these journals on the education of new American citizens from abroad. Let's see. So then he goes on celebrating documentary, I guess coins the term. He read and agreed with the journalist and political philosopher Walter Lippmann's book, Public Opinion. So he's getting to study media. An early guy, at least in his world. Let's see. Grierson's emerging view of film was as a form of social and political communication, a mechanism for social reform, education, perhaps spiritual uplift. His view of Hollywood movie-making was considerably less sanguine. He said, in an age when the faith, F-A-I-T-H-S, the loyalties and the purposes have been more than usually undermined, mental fatigue... Or is it spiritual fatigue represents a large factor in everyday experience? Our cinema magnate does no more than exploit the occasion. He also, more or less frankly, is a dope peddler. I guess the guy who makes movies. Our cinema magnate does no more than exploit the occasion. He also, more or less frankly, is a dope peddler. Now, this is interesting. This is early media analysis. And Don got to hang out with this guy.
Right. But this is... for the Canadian analysis of American culture.
Yeah.
This is a fairly typical up to sometime, I guess, in the 1970s or so. But everybody that was thinking in Canada was warning about American films, American television, American advertising, all this sort of stuff, as being a social
poison. Social poison.
Yeah, social dynamite, I was going to say. So, and what's happened to Canada is that it completely ignored all of that and just kept consuming more and more American films, more and more American everything.
Because it was nature, new nature. You couldn't stop consuming it. It was vital, regardless of the content. Media,
yeah,
new nature.
That's right. But the there was, for McLuhan, but not only McLuhan, for Innes and Grant, and for many people like this, Grierson, being in an environment with no way out was also posed a demand on understanding.
Yeah.
And so it's not the case that we're in this environment and that's the last word. We're in this environment and we need to think about where we are and what the alternatives are. And what's happened in Canada, is, as far as I can see, is that the entire country has just become fixated on sort of aping America. And it's lost
the part of America that is in escape velocity. You know what I mean? It's totally irresponsible.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, no, Canadians aren't doing too good.
Oh, terrible. Terrible. They've lost their country.
Right, yeah. So they think they're doing okay because America keeps looking stupider and stupider in the White House, so that makes them feel superior. But they're actually, they're down lower. There's a lower thing they're comparing themselves to, so they're not knowing how low they're going.
Yeah, well, to me, Canadians are, they retain this sort of self-satisfied, we're smarter than everybody kind of attitude.
We're nicer than anybody.
Yeah, exactly. But meanwhile, we don't know how our money is being spent. We don't want to admit that we're making life much more dangerous for our grandchildren. We don't like to admit that we're being led by the nose, not even by Americans, by, the initial agencies like the CIA.
Yeah.
We're being led by the nose all around the world by these folks, and we don't even know who they are, what they're doing with us.
Yeah, in that sense, you and I are too, we're like Dante. We're Canadians in exile. Disgusted
That's
with
right.
the country and not acknowledging our leadership. I used to say that my people, what was it? Okay, so they said De Gaulle was in exile, so the government was in exile. I said, I'm at headquarters, my people are in exile.
uh-huh.
You know, or flip the De Gaulle scenario, where he was in England during the war, he was the government in exile.
That's
well,
right. Well, I mean, I understand completely what you're saying.
Yeah.
It's just in typical fashion, you like to take the high road and I like to take the low road. Right?
That's because I'm a low person and you're a high person. So we go our opposite selves. We put out our opposites.
Correct. Correct.
You're a lot more respectable than me. You actually worked in digital jobs. You actually know something about the efficient causality of digital reality. I bypass
very little.
You know a lot more than me. Anybody does than me. I my alibi is, I study the effects. I'm into formal causality. But I find it very interesting reading about Grierson and thinking of Don's hanging out with this guy. There's this article. I'll try to find it, send it to you. I think it was a student of Don, Paul Teasel, or one of those guys. He wrote about Wyndham Lewis, John Grierson, and a couple other guys, Canadian thinkers. He probably threw in McLuhan, but it was sort of just before McLuhan. The fountain of Canadian media studies is Grierson and Lewis and some other guys. I'll see if I can find it. Have you seen the essay? Do you know what I mean?
No, I haven't seen the essay, but I know of the kind of thinking that was going on. And even John O'Neill was part of that thinking as well.
Right.
These were people that thought that McLuhan had abandoned any kind of social concern.
Right.
And didn't understand the negative side of what he was talking about. By being a kind of Pollyanna of technology, he was just more or less working for the CIA. So they, for them, there was little to think about in McLuhan. He was somebody who had, for one reason or another, given up thinking about what was most important to think about.
Right. And now Don, he knew all these people, the Andy McLuhan mm-hmm. faction, and he was the subtle double agent. He might agree with their objections to McLuhan, and he would spell that more in his first book, The Medium is a Rearview Mirror. But he kept loyal to the value of McLuhan way more than anybody else. And mm-hmm. so mm-hmm. he ends up being the promoter of McLuhan, even though he'd hung out with all the naysayers who had those exact things. So I found the essay. Here's what it's called. From Literary Modernism to the Tantramar Marshes, which are in Nova Scotia, Anticipating McLuhan in British and Canadian Media Theory and Practice by Paul Teason at Wilfrid Laurier. I'm pretty sure he was a student of Don Thiel, and I think I have Paul Teason's PhD in my garage because I got a lot of his students' PhDs when I got the library from Don. So listen to this. The abstract. This study offers brief sketches of four 20th century cultural analysts and activists. It examines their work and illustrates the extent to which a fairly sophisticated McLuhan-esque sensibility was operating in Canada in intellectual and government circles from the 1920s to the 1940s, 10 years prior to the arrival of Marshall McLuhan. The four figures are John Grierson, Wyndham Lewis, Graham Spry. Do you know Graham Spry?
That Definitely. Name? Yeah.
You do?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Graham Spry was married to the woman that was the right-hand person of Harold Innes.
Married to the worker of, co-worker of Innes, secretary or something.
Yeah. Not a secretary, no. She was a grad student and a PhD and was sort of Innes's designated follower. The person that he wanted to sort of hand off his life's work and she would continue it. And when she got married to Spry, then Innes took that as a betrayal.
What? What?
Yeah.
What did he want her to do? Stay single?
Sort of. I think so.
And what was her name?
And there were rumors that they were lovers. I don't know if that's
right.
The case or not.
What was her name?
I wrote some posts on this. I forget her name. If you want me to look it up, I can. But
I'll look it up. So Graham Spry and Gerald Noxon, Noxon. Does that mean anything to you?
No.
Right. Now what this guy is? He's not including Innes, but I guess this is the 20s and 40s. This is supposedly before Innes, but you probably wouldn't agree with that.
Well, Innes sort of had the same fate as McLuhan. Innes was regarded as a right-wing figure because he was always doing royal commissions, and he was active in the administration of University of Toronto, and he was studying business people. So even though Innes today strikes us as a very sort of revolutionary thinker, at the time, the left-wing guys didn't dig Innes at all.
Yeah, he was too a part of the establishment. I mean, he was a major
absolutely.
Figure. So whereas McLuhan, in the more decentralized 60s and 70s, never got to that level of status of Innes in university bureaucracy, but it's a decentralized environment, so they're suspicious of his floating work for the CIA. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's a
yeah,
different
yeah.
environment. Same
yeah.
same complaint. So
mm-hmm.
Listen to this. So during his adult
Is Havelock mentioned as one of those left-wing thinkers in media? No. Oh, my God. Havelock was doing great work in Canada in
great.
The 1930s and 1940s.
This is how Croker ends his book. He's saying the debate between Havelock and McLuhan is the foundational debate of our issues today. And then he makes a big story out of Havelock understood the disservices of oral culture. McLuhan celebrated the coming retrieved oral culture in the technological utopia and did not see the reactionary conservative nature of oral culture that Havelock did. Now, I say to Croker, no, that's the content or culture.
That's absolute nonsense.
That's right. He's missing. McLuhan predicted the tactile culture, not the oral culture. That was the big rearview mirror for people, especially in understanding McLuhan. So, yes, he makes a big – it's like he's trying to be part of the Toronto School of Communication and find an issue that he invents to put himself in critical position that all you guys don't notice the core deep ground debate that McLuhan and Havelock were having. And it's all, like you say, nonsense. So that's how he ends his book. So not too cool there. But Croker was never proper and accurate around McLuhan.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. So we'll end with this. You got to go. Noxon, during his adult years in Canada, Gerald Noxon worked for the NFB from 40 to 41, with the CBC from 41 to 47. His career is yet another kind of articulation of some of the strands of thought and practice, which I, Paul, am offering as a succinct summary of early McLuhanism, for he was active for at least 10 years in British film and radio circles, beginning in the late 20s, and then in Canadian film and radio circles during the 40s. Like Spry, he advocated for Canada a nationalist model of broadcast control, but looking beyond Canada to the world, he envisioned by 1945 a global audience for a specifically Canadian media voice. Born in 1910, such a program, Noxon argued from Cambridge, would, as it did in the USSR, create a defense against the American Hollywood system. Yeah, there's your point. So he was one of those guys. I guess you could say the left, right? So that's Noxon. Now you know. So I'm going to send you this article. You might find it interesting.
Yeah, I would. I'd like to see that.
Yeah, and in the article, what I learned from it, you know, when I read it like 10 years ago or something, the Tantrum of Marshes is near Amherst, Nova Scotia, near where Lewis was born. And they built a tower there in 1939, which was the way the Canadians could communicate with Europe through World War II. So here's when the tower was built, right by Lewis, and we can consider Lewis actually the fountainhead of this stuff, a lot of it. And he's there born at the fountainhead where the tower is going to be. What's that, 80 to 40, 60 years later after he's born, they put a tower there. So there's that element in the Tantramar Marshes, okay?
Yeah.
So this is your homework till we meet again.
Okay. I know that the woman that married Spry, her first name was Irene, and I'm trying to think of her last name, but I haven't been able to. But I'll send you that.
Yeah, when you
so
find
you,
it
you
in
send,
your... Yeah.
You send me the essay that you're talking about, and I will send you the information on Harold Innes.
And yeah. I have the biography of Innes, which goes into the great influence of Lewis on him. I'll just walk out and look up Irene in there. I might come across the name.
Although this quote-unquote great influence of Lewis on Innes, that's nonsense, too.
Oh, no, what are you saying? What's not the Havelock and...
No, I'm saying I'm saying it's nonsense that Innes was greatly influenced by Lewis.
You'll have to read the book. He lays out a good case.
I've read the book, believe me.
You've read the book.
The only reason that Innes knew anything at all about Lewis was that he met McLuhan in 1947, and he would have got the essay on Lewis that McLuhan wrote in 43 in St. Louis.
Yeah.
And that's full of quotes from The Art of Being Ruled and from the Time and Western Man. And those are the only things that Innes ever quotes from Innes.
Well, maybe that's all he needs to quote.
From Lewis.
That's all he needs to quote. He got the basic medium of the message.
But that's not reading an essay of McLuhan and talking to McLuhan about Lewis. Those aren't the same things as being deeply influenced by him.
How about this? McLuhan, it's right after that he does the bias of communication. After he hears about Lewis, reads Lewis, gets it, sees how it relates to his work, and then produces Empire and Communications and the bias of communication. So I don't know what you're saying there. Lewis can have a quick influence. The final thing that pushes him into being Innes and getting it straight. And McLuhan, so McLuhan then pretends that he didn't really know Innes until he reads Bias of Communication, and it's quoting Lewis. No, it quotes his Mechanical Bride, and he's stunned by that.
Nah.
You know, I heard him say that.
Bob,
BBC.
This is
in the 60s he said this. You know that story. Yeah. He claimed that that's how he found out about it. About Innes.
Bob, we've talked about this in the past.
I know, and then we find out that he knew Innes in the 40s, right.
Yeah.
But so McLuhan made Innes into a McLuhan by giving him the poison of Lewis. I rest my case with that statement there.
What you would have to do is you would have to reread the 1946 book of Innes. And you would see that in 1946, he was well on his way to communications theory. And this was before he ever met or heard of McLuhan.
He was ready. But Lewis he sort of read Lewis and understood and said, gee, Lewis got there before me. And then that gives him confidence. And at the same time, McLuhan is deeply being influenced by Ezra Pound, the late 40s, early 50s. There's the Pound thing that nobody talks about. That's what Ted Carpenter used to say. Pound was the big influence on McLuhan. And I've seen some evidence of that, but that's another story. But so we have an interesting...
That's we can talk about this another day.
Right.
But, that's all. Pound definitely did have a big influence on McLuhan, and it was associated with the influence that film... in general, and Eisenstein in particular, had on McLuhan.
Yeah.
So Eisenstein was a person whose theory played up the importance of the ideogram.
Yeah.
And then McLuhan finds out that Pound had been talking about the ideogram. And so then he reads Pound and Eisenstein together in the late 1940s. And that's one side of the what could be called the globalization of McLuhan's sensibility.
Yeah, that gets him out of the book bias, where he says,
correct.
I've been reading
correct.
English literature for 20 years and wasting my time. Why didn't somebody tell me about this stuff? Right?
That's right. Yeah, but then he goes on to teach English literature for another 30 years.
he never taught English literature. Look, he taught media. Come on. He writes in 53 that Finney's Wake is all about media's art forms. Nobody knew what that meant.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how he interpreted it. So, yeah, he dropped English in the early 50s.
Let's say. But, he continued to write... his T.S. Eliot book. He continued to write what are fairly recognizable essays in English literature. So he was, McLuhan was a very fragmented guy, and that's, we both agree that that's his great virtue.
Yeah.
But, that, but in his fragmentation, it becomes ridiculous to say that, you know, one person or one movement or something was the decisive thing.
Yeah,
no.
I would have to go back to my quadrifini point that he never gave up English studies, but he also did. He included so many new worlds.
The great word in what you just said is also.
Yeah.
So the McLuhan was able to confront the complexities of the modern world and find a way, as we said earlier, to surfboard on them.
Yeah. And what Ian always says, I'll mention something, he says something, then I'll add something. He go, as well. That's Marshall. As well. He went over there, as well. You know, and then he did this, as well. As well, he did this.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You get that?
Yes, sir.
All right. So we end with a fine flourish of clashing symbols.
Okay, good.
Okay,
so
thanks a lot, Cameron.
Send me that essay. I'll be interested to see it.
Right now. Okay.
Good.
Talk to you soon.
Yeah, look forward. Bye-bye.
Bye.